what a good way, great way to end that set there in Rocky Top, Tennessee. But this is Rocky Mountains, Colorado. Hey, Bonnie, welcome.
Thanks for inviting me up here in the snowstorm.
All right. Yeah, we, you know, it's a special greeting we gave you here. So yes. That's the voice of Bonnie McCune. And we're going to transition here over to some writer's talk. And so I'll be introducing Bonnie a little bit more thoroughly here in just a minute. But I want to thank all our sponsors, because without community radio, or without sponsors, community radio like this is not possible. And I'm bringing you this program here. So learn about my work, Sisyphus Wins. Go to jerryfabianica.com. And this past hour, I got to spin some tunes, but right now we got some writer's talk coming up. And with me in the studio is Bonnie McCune. And, you know, and we are recording this, by the way. And so all the recordings, all the podcasts, if you will, are at my website. You can go to either jerryfabianic.com or Big Horn Book Club and get quite a few more there. And Bonnie is getting to be a regular here on the show. You're a veteran. You're coming back.
That's right. I learn every time I come here, I learn so much. So I'm happy to trek out from the big city.
Oh, sweet. Okay. And she's been writing, Bonnie McCune. She's been writing since age 10 when she submitted a poem about rain rushing down the gutter to the Saturday Evening Post. But it was sadly not accepted. but her interest, that interest facilitated her career in nonprofits along public and community relations and marketing. She's worked for libraries, directed a small arts organization, managed Denver's beautification program. Simultaneously, she's been a freelance writer with publications in local, regional, and specialty publications for news and features. Her civic involvement includes grassroots organizations, political campaigns, writers and arts groups, and children's literacy. For years, she's entered recipe contests and was a finalist in the Pillsbury Bake Off. How did that go?
It was so much fun. It was, I think, in Houston, and I found that contests enable me to travel without having to pay the expenses, so I had a great time, although I didn't win it.
What did you submit? What was your...
My recipe, I called it peanut butter sticky buns.
Oh.
So it was a sweet roll in a crescent roll.
Okay, nice. Okay, did you have any nuts on there, you know, like...
Yeah, peanuts, yes.
The peanuts themselves, yeah. Okay, yeah. Not the pecans and nuts. No, uh-uh. You get the cinnamon ones.
I didn't get that fancy.
Oh, it sounds wonderful. If you'd have brought some right now, I'd be diving right into it. And you have a special love for live theater, too.
Yeah. I love to go and watch it. I think live theater offers an opportunity to immerse yourself into what is an alternative reality. Movies are great, but to me, they don't have the same excitement that live theater has.
Yeah, there's something about that. You know, when you get to, you know, it doesn't have to be a big Broadway play or anything like that, but did you see the performers? And in a small venue.
Right.
Especially not the name of the theaters, but like on South Broadway, and then there's a Curious Theater down there now.
Right. Vintage out in Aurora. There's, quite a few in Denver.
Very nice. But your first love is writing and fiction.
Writing, yes. Writing fiction.
Yeah. What got you into that?
You know, I always have written it. It's like the poem that I wrote when I was 10. I remember when I was in seventh grade, I wrote a play. And you will see kind of a theme going through my writing. I wrote a play, and it was about a kid getting trapped in a refrigerator. Ooh. Because in those days, you did not have safety features.
Yeah.
So I thought, oh, I'll do a play and lecture kids my age. They should never get into an empty refrigerator and close the door.
Right.
It was never produced. I think I still have it somewhere. I should dig it out and see.
Might be fun, you know, resurrect that a little bit there, you know, and it might lead into another story, though.
Or well, that's true.
You know, a subplot of your, you know, one of your other stories, too. You never know, right?
But then in high school, of course, in English, they always had us writing. And again, I always seemed to have some kind of social message that went with my writing. And I have had short stories published and have won some prizes. And I've worked on novels just for years and years, but I really didn't get a novel published until 2012.
Okay, and that was your first one. So what's the name of that one?
That one was called, I can't remember. Saints.
Saints?
The Saints.
Okay, and yeah, because I'm looking at your site there, and you got Heart Strong. I remember Falling Like a Rock. We talked about that last time we read that. Yeah. Okay. And then the Irish episode?
Irish episodes, I actually self-published. It's a novella. Mm-hmm. And I did that in 2012, too. And then I found a publisher, and I published the Saints Come Stumbling In. That's what I called it. The Saints Come Stumbling In.
They don't just come walking in, baby. No, they stumble in. I wonder what caused them to stumble. We could play around with that metaphorically, you know. Yeah.
Well, the heroine, and I guess this is another kind of theme. My heroine was kind of a klutz, mm-hmm. both physically and emotionally.
I see.
So I think most of my heroines are kind of klutz-like.
So very human.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And when you're writing, Bonnie, do you focus, and I know they're both critical, both character development and the story flow, the story arc and so on. What it seems to be, you know, what you really went to, you mentioned like social issues might loop in there somehow or other. But when you're writing, what tends to be your emphasis?
Well, I really think it's character because for me, a character, a person's life, whether it's a human life or a fictional life, combines many, many different elements. And a person is not just a single dimension. So that mm-hmm. the depth of the character is what gives depth to the story.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that comes about? I'm with you on that, too. I mean, I enjoy a well-told story.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, could be a murder mystery, that sort of thing there.
Right.
But when I get into a work in which the character is richly developed and mm-hmm. is very complex and is rounded and so on, for me, it seems it comes out of like my love for the classics. So if you're reading Dostoevsky or Steinbeck, you know, whatever, you're reading character. I mean, you're reading stories too, but there's something rich about those various characters in there. What's your thinking on that?
Well, and I'm sure you already know this, but I'll just throw it out there. When you have a rich character, it doesn't matter really when the piece was written, mm-hmm. you will find something to relate to. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in War and Peace, there are themes about war and brutality and love that are kind of eternal or very human over the centuries. So that is what emphasizing character can bring to a work of fiction. Mm-hmm. Certainly thrillers, mysteries, romances, they all kind of skew it in a certain way, but any good writer will develop the characters.
Yeah, and so in a way, it's not to poo-poo that story, you know, the well-told story, but there's almost like a timeliness to them that, you know, if it's written, you know, murder mystery back in the 80s, for example, because of the advances in technology with the crime scenes, for example,
uh-huh.
you know, it's kind of like picking up, you know, the old landline to Prince's phone rather than using the cell phone.
Right.
Yeah, that sort of thing there. But the eternity of a rich character, and I'm trying to think the unknown God, it's the Steinbeck novel, and the man goes out to San Francisco. I don't know if you've read that one. And there's a character in there. His name is Joseph. And he has this spiritual connection to the land, and his brother is a very religious individual who finds him as a pagan and so forth, and that sets up the drama in the story there too, and how it and such a rich character. Now Steinbeck wrote that, you know, and it was not one of his great works per se, but he wrote it back in late 20s, early 30s. You read it today, and if you're into that type of, you know, outdoors or whatever, that spirituality, it still resonates.
It certainly does. But it's funny, with technology, it's funny to think back about how far we've come. And I realized that decades ago, I read a fair amount of science fiction. No science fiction writer, the only one I can think of that really did was Asimov, who pictured computers as complex as or even more complex than the ones we have today. Mm-hmm. You know, if you look at the early Star Trek, they didn't have communication devices that were as advanced as the ones we have today. So it certainly can, the technology can date a work of fiction, but that's all right because you can enter that world and live in that time.
Yeah, and you go back even farther with science fiction, The Day the Earth Stood Still with Michael Rennie. Oh my God, 1951. And you know, you watch that movie and it still give you chills because emphasis was on, you know, warring nations and so on there. And how timely is that?
Right.
Oh my God. Yeah. So, you know, you're right here in Colorado. And you've been writing 5-6 years popularly now. Mm-hmm. Your sense of Colorado being like ground zero for popular fiction, does it play well here?
I think it does. And it is always surprising to me how much people are infatuated just with the concept of Colorado. I just came back from a writing conference that was put on by a Canadian group, and most of the people there were Canadians. But as soon as you say Colorado, they get this kind of dazed look in their eyes like, oh, this is, it's so wonderful. And part of it is because I think of the natural environment. I mean, we're here right now in Idaho Springs, and you see wonderful, wonderful trees and plants growing, and you see the unexpected snow, and then the unexpected, oh, a couple of days ago in Denver, they had the terrible winds, but that was kind of fun just to experience it. So in Colorado, it seems to me that nature is so ever-present and so tangible that it really becomes a plus to use it when you are writing fiction.
Mm-hmm. And I remember a month or so ago at the Colorado Book Fest at the public library, and I sat on a panel to discuss how our landscape shapes our character and how we reflect off of that. So I would ask people, and I said, well, those of you, and most of us are immigrants, we moved to the state. Right. Why did you come? Well, primarily because of the mountains. Mm-hmm. And people who are native born, why do you stay? Primarily because of the mountains.
That's right.
And there's something about that richness. And I actually went to Wyoming for a class example for me, Brokeback Mountain.
Oh, yes.
That story could only be set in Wyoming.
Yeah.
It wouldn't play out in Colorado, even though it's, you know, that. But the land itself, it just adds so much.
Well, in many ways, no matter where you're from, if you are alert to what's going on around you, you can find things that you love and things that you hate. So I'm not saying that if you are a writer from Pittsburgh that you can't set it in Pittsburgh. It's just different. And people are kind of enchanted, as I said, by Colorado's environment.
Yeah, and it's interesting you single out Pittsburgh because initially that's where I grew up. And that mentality of the shot in the beer crowd and everything, the steel there. Mm-hmm. And even though very little steel is produced anymore in Pittsburgh, it's the culture of the people that's there. And it's a very hilly area. And you know, the thing that's really flat is the downtown area. And that is really just, once you leave there, man, you're and it's very hilly. And that also is reflected in the characters of those people. So it's a real interesting experience to go there.
Well, and I think this just demonstrates how wonderful it is to be, I sound like a cockeyed optimist, but to be alive anywhere, as long as you're alert and your eyes are open and you're willing to take a little chance and meet people and talk to them and mix with them, there's always something that you can learn and something that you can appreciate.
Well, let's talk about your work. Your latest work is Never Retreat.
Right.
Okay. And talk about conscious points when you're developing the character that you try to work into the character, her, him, that reflects, you know, that help bring that home more. And then if so, and how, you know, like in your particular work here, Never Retreat, what are those characters?
There is a woman in her 30s. She's a single mother, and there is an ex-military corporate star in his mid to late 30s, and he moves back to the headquarters, and they, of course, rub each other the wrong way, but inevitably since it's women's fiction, you know that probably they're going to get together. So that's kind of a given. But, you know, now that you ask me about them, I don't know how I found those characters. It is so strange how people can kind of just pop up in your mind and then they develop. And there were certain aspects. The heroine's name is Ray. There are certain aspects that occurred to me just as I went through the process of writing, which for me is a several-year process. But because I've always been cognizant of social issues, I did want to include – I didn't want to make everybody cookie-cutter, Anglo-suburban, right, middle-income. So I have had good friends who were Latina, so I made her half Latina, and I had her in the book run up against certain situations in which prejudice raises its head, and she has to deal with it. Her best friend is a Latina, too. And then ex-military, my husband was a Marine. I grew up in the 60s, though, so I was certainly part of the anti-war movement. So I thought, why on earth do I have this ex-military man in this book? But he just seemed to fit.
Right.
And he came back and became very successful in the corporate world. So I have this very strong hero, and in a way that set off the instant antagonism between the two, because she made assumptions about him. And in this particular novel, the man is absolutely more flexible, more willing to compromise, more willing to take a risk than the heroine.
Oh,
so she had to learn from him probably much more than in many novels you would expect.
And so in a way, because we stereotype,
right,
that the men are the more rigid and the women are the more malleable, but you kind of flip that gender role.
That's right. And one thing that I tried to show with the hero, whose name is Dez, is that each character has to learn something through the process of the novel, but he was much more willing to take a risk despite his kind of checkered background with other women. And he really very much wanted to settle down and discovered very early on that this is a woman that he wanted to spend some time with.
Now, Dez is a former military man?
Right.
Okay, because then I'm thinking that in the rigidity of a military outfit, which it needs to be in order for it to function, and yet he's now stepping away from, so is that in reaction to, those sorts of things start to run through my mind because you get this, again, this very interesting character that, you know, we say, okay, ex-Marine, you know, Semper Fi, and they're going to be this way. And I have met a number of authors who are former military, particularly a couple in the Marines, and they're not quite in that stereotype there.
That's right.
Yeah, so
I think everybody tends to stereotype in a way, and it's both a strength and a weakness, because if you study the human brain, our ability to generalize was something that helped us survive. You know, if you have a brush with a saber-toothed tiger, you better learn to generalize that saber-toothed tigers are not going to be your friends.
Right.
So that trait helped humans to survive. But in other situations, it can be a limitation. So you have to almost consciously force yourself not to accept stereotypes that pop into your mind. And certainly in today's political scene, the, you know, Me Too or whatever that movement is called, people are beginning to realize that they can't just, men shouldn't stereotype women and women shouldn't stereotype men.
Interesting, yeah. And because you also brought in like the corporate,
right,
the ladder climber.
Right.
And it's always an interesting little New York Times crossword puzzle answer. It's a four-letter word. What do we call them?
I don't know. What?
A suit.
Oh, a suit, yes. Yes. I love that, yes.
Yeah, and so when we think of someone in a suit, a man in a suit, and even a woman,
uh-huh.
when she dresses up uh-huh. in a suit, you think of, you know, you see the commercials or the TV programs, and she's an attorney in the courtroom, right?
Uh-huh.
She doesn't come in a pink blouse or anything. Like, it's always this navy blue, and, you know, it could be a pantsuit, it could be, you know, whatever, but right. it's a suit. And so there's this rigidity to that, you know, that you're projecting there. And
but you, this, see, if you know the kind of unwritten rules, you can use that to your own advantage. Years ago, there was a book called Games Mother Never Taught Me. Mm. And she advised in there, dress for what you want. And she mentioned, if you want to be an artist, maybe you should run around in a paint-smeared smock.
Right.
And it's true. Another thing that happened to me that convinced me of this, not too long ago, I went in for a doctor's appointment, and a woman came in to the examination room, and she was dressed in jeans and a casual shirt. She had absolutely no identity or badge of medical. And she started asking me questions about my health and my physical well-being, and I thought, who is this woman? And I really wanted to advise the health center that there is a reason your staff should wear medical kinds of paraphernalia. Because
uh-huh.
I didn't have nearly the instantaneous trust in her that I would in a doctor that came in with a doctor's uniform or a nurse in right. the nurse's trappings.
Yeah, and I was ready. The punchline must have been, she was the doctor.
you know, I think she was a nurse, but she certainly right. didn't come off as professional to me just because of her clothing.
Yeah, and in that situation, that's what we want to be, too.
Right.
And I find it fascinating, too, because I think as writers, and I'm not sure if we develop the skill or we become writers because we already have it, is to observe human nature.
That's right.
No matter where you go, watch the people and just, you know, non-judgmentally,
uh-huh.
what are they like?
Uh-huh.
And then realize that you're only seeing this one aspect and you are filtering it through your own lens, you know, uh-huh. psychologically uh-huh. and everything. And then to take that and put it into a story and start to play with that.
And actually with this novel, Ray, the heroine, is very aware of clothing because her best friend, Julia, is an admin assistant. And she, and again, I don't know where this came from, but she dresses more casually or less formally. And Ray consciously assumes like almost a uniform, a corporate uniform. Mm-hmm. She ties her hair back so it's not flying all over. And then when she goes to the corporate retreat in the mountains, she undoes that and her hair can fly around a bit.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think that we as writers observe this kind of thing just so we can use writing as an excuse to observe everything and learn about it.
Well, and I think that's the richness of literature, too, and that, you know, so we were talking earlier about character. We still are.
Uh-huh.
And the story, how it unfolds around it. And other times, you know, you're reading the story, and they're good characters, but they're not ones that really you can just, you know, sink your teeth into and wonder about because it's the storyline itself. A murder mystery is a
right.
classic example of that sort of thing there. And those are fine, you know, there. So I just learned so much, you know, the different style or genres, if you will, in works of fiction.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, mine I like to call women's fiction because, you know, when I first started out, and even now with this book, sometimes people will say, oh, well, that's a romance. But I call it women's fiction because I feel like it has more levels to it. There's more development or I hope, learning by the characters about mm-hmm. what they want and how they can get it. Mm-hmm. I like to think that there's kind of a new fiction for women that does deal with issues more, that isn't afraid to talk about things like racial prejudice or mm-hmm. The fact that there's a glass ceiling, especially a glass ceiling for women who are not Anglo. And those can be dealt with in a fairly light novel by inserting these kinds of thoughts and discussions. It doesn't have to be beat people over the head and lecture. In fact, it's better if it comes through character so people can think, oh, I know somebody kind of like that. I wonder if she ever felt like that.
Right. It seems that then through these characters that are well developed, it adds legitimacy and also revelations for themselves. And when I wrote my book initially, I had projected it in a certain way, and we're always taught, who's your audience? And I find out that the different people who have read it have glammed on to different aspects.
That's great.
And so that helped me understand, and appreciate the complexity of the characters themselves and then of the story too, that even different people, different genders, different races could pull something out of that and say, I can identify with him because of my experience over here. And it seems to me that that also helps then legitimize or, I'm searching for the word. I can't think right offhand. But, how we feel personally and we discover something about ourselves. And then we say, you know what? It's okay.
Yeah.
I'm okay to feel this way or I'm okay to be this way.
But it always takes me by surprise when somebody reads something of mine and they interpret it completely differently from what I had meant. And I can't think of an example offhand, but, I might think, this is especially true with people you give to do what's called beta reading or critique your stuff. And people can say, this character is so irritating. Why is she doing this and this? And I think, I didn't mean her to be irritating. Why is she? I guess I must be irritating because a lot of the characters have something in common with me.
Well, and maybe it's okay for that character to be irritating.
That's right.
So what's triggering the irritation within that particular person? Not that you ask your beta reader to sit down and psychoanalyze her, like this, and say, well, that's interesting, because then why is that? What is it, it's hitting that raw nerve or pushing that button in me? Well, maybe because, 20 years ago, yada, yada. Yeah.
Well, that's one good thing about, there are many good things about growing older, I need to assure your listeners, but one of the good things about growing older is you get to the point when it's just, que sera, sera. If somebody feels that way, I'm glad they took the time to read it and think about it, and that's fine. I can live with it.
You brought up women's fiction here, and before I ask the question here, I do want to go on and just do station identification, saying this is Jerry Fabianic on KYGT, LPFM 102.7, 103.9. This is Writer's Talk on the Rabbit Hole, visiting here with Bonnie McCune and talking about her works. The latest one is Never Retreat. And, so we talk about women's literature or fiction, men's, and I'm a retired English teacher, and we just have great discussions within our department. So if you're reading Steinbeck as opposed to reading Toni Morrison, and why is that a different experience? And I have one young man, he's not so young anymore, a fellow, he was a colleague, and his point was that men and women write differently.
Mm-hmm.
Men tend to be more linear, and women will go, it's kind of like the driving thing.
Mm-hmm.
If you give a man directions, say you go down to this traffic light and you look for the stop sign, right? And it's stereotyping, I get it, but you say women, and there's this beautiful bush over there, with the gardenias hanging, whatever. And so it's a different way of processing and moving through information. Your thoughts on that, Bonnie?
Oh, I agree totally. And I don't think one is necessarily better than the other. And I think there is a lot of overlap. When I was in school and studying psychology, they always talked about the bell curve, the one that is narrower on the right and narrower on the left, and then it goes up like a mountain in the middle. But they always emphasized that regardless of whatever you were applying this to, there was always overlap. So to define a person solely by his or her sex or gender is defeating yourself. So there are men who will sit in a movie and cry. Heck, my dad used to cry, and he was, if you had just met him, you would have said, this is the toughest guy in the world. But he used to cry in movies. And there are women who are very very aggressive, and you know, women are starting to feel like they have permission maybe to be overly aggressive. But in the bell curve, yes, there is a difference, I think, between men and women. And one of the things is, I personally think that women writers tend to emphasize characters and details more than men in general. So I mentioned I read science fiction. I read it for years. And it used to be very few women wrote science fiction, almost none. There was a woman named Andre Norton, and I didn't know if it was a man or a woman. But when I read her stuff, I thought, oh, I really like her stuff because her characters are so rich. And I think that's one thing in the area of science fiction. When more women started writing science fiction, you started getting more character development. So if you read Heinlein, or if you read, well, now he slipped my mind, they tended years ago to be much more stereotyped in their approach to even characters' gender. And if you read old Asimov's stuff, he very rarely had women as protagonists. He had them as secondary characters. And I think it was the time he lived in. But now, if you pick up science fiction, you will see lots and lots of women writing science fiction. And I think the men have begun to feel, maybe they didn't even think of it, but they've begun to feel, I have permission to be more emotional in my writing too. So I think breaking down those gender stereotypes has helped both men and women writers.
Yeah, and I agree with you on that. And I'll go back just as a little example, into the classics. Oh my God, you read Moby Dick, Ahab.
Almost no women in that.
Oh, yeah, right. There are no women
unless
in it.
Unless the whale was a woman, we don't know.
They just make references to their wives and everything. But Ahab himself, you know, now he's taken on the universe. That is such a – there's no other character like him, you know, in that regard. And there's so much, you know, you can pull out of there. And you mentioned about men crying at movies. I used to show – because I would teach American history at the eighth grade level. And as part of the Civil War unit, I would show the movie – do you ever remember Shenandoah with Jimmy Stewart?
Oh, yes.
Oh, my God. That last scene where the boy hobbles into church, every time I would, as soon as it would come, I would kind of step back of the room because I knew I was going to lose it.
Uh-huh.
And there was something powerful about that scene, that boy who was lost and, you know, given up. And yet there it is, you know, and it just shows the richness again. It's not so much about the war, it's about the people that are in the war that are, in this conflict there, you know, and there's the final example is someone I met now, and you know, he's an author, and he's written a work. It's set in war, and when I read the work, and I was telling him about his character and how he changes and how it develops, you know, in the story, and I don't think he really understood that as much until I brought it to his attention. He went, "Yeah," because his focus was on what happened in the war and everything like this. And yet he's not the same guy at the end of the story.
Yes.
And that's what's so huge when you're reading something. So even if they're irritating up front, do you fall in love with them at the end there? Or do you empathize?
That's
right. And that's what great literature, I think, should be about.
Now, I do know that even years ago, women could be main characters. I'm thinking of Main Street, which I read just a couple of years ago, and there is a wonderful woman protagonist in it. And I'm always puzzled, how did this man figure out that's the way women think? But he did. Strange to say, years ago when I was in college, I took a creative writing class, and it was taught by a married couple, a man and a woman, and she actually said in that class, men can write about women characters, but women, for some reason, are not able to write about male characters. Isn't that strange?
Interesting.
So maybe at that time, it was a generalization that had some truth. And maybe breaking down the barriers in things, even things as kind of horrendous to me as massive lists of swear words. Maybe that has made women feel more comfortable about being honest when they write about male characters.
Well, and I think, it's an interesting point there, because in my novel I'm writing right now, and I developed these two women characters, secondary characters, but they have powerful roles. One's right. Kind of like a brain surgeon, very, a powerful medical doctor. The other one is a psychotherapist. So very professional developed. And I want to have this scene or two where they're just the two of them are talking. And I sat and I thought, how would two women get together? One's, medical, the other one's, psychological. They're both, professionals. And when they get together, what is that like? How do I paint that scene? Well, for guys, I could just put them in a bar and, there you are. You're just chatted up, or you go to a baseball game or something like that. And I really sat there and I had to think,
So where did you put them?
They start off a little bit in a happy hour. And then uh-huh. one says, well, could you come over to my flat there? And I have some wine. Uh-huh. And so they get over there and they got the hot tub. And she says, oh, I got all these robes. So they go and sit in a hot tub and start having this conversation on a very serious topic, and they're having a glass of wine. And I thought, that's more, because two men generally don't get in a hot tub and start talking. Right? The two women will.
Women will.
Yeah.
And that's a perfect scene to me.
Yeah. So I had to really shift my head and say, where can I get this here? And then the conversation is not as all direct. Yeah. It'll go off on tangents, and then they'll come back to the point, too. So it was an interesting challenge for me. When my editor gets a hold of it, she'll probably want to rework a lot of stuff in there, too, which is fine, to make it all the better. But well, still, it gets back to that.
You can always eavesdrop, go into a restaurant or a bar, and just sit there. Now, don't make it too obvious, or the women will say, this man is just listening to everything we say. Yeah. What's wrong with
him? Yeah, can I record your conversation? I'm simply going to, go to those. And one of the advantages I had, as because I taught with your brother-in-law, so a little shout out to Marty, right?
That's right.
But having spent my career in a field pretty dominated by women, so go to happy hours, get to know them socially too. So, and I grew up in a family with eight sisters, so I'm not intimidated by that, but it's still, I had to really shift my thinking, to create a realistic scene, for these two very professional women to have this serious conversation about where would that take place and how does that take place? So again, that gender, stuff that we were talking here.
Yeah. But, frequently it's very subtle stuff. I remember, again, when I was in college in this writing class, there was a young man in that class that I had known casually, and we all had to write stuff. So he wrote something, and I can't even remember what it was, but something with a male character thinking and brooding over, life and love. And I said to him, do men think like this? And he said, yes, I had never thought that men had those kind of internal conversations or eureka points with themselves, and it was an eye-opener.
Yeah, they do, but they just can't really show it because you have to always have that macho experience.
Yeah.
Talk about character, and go back to something we were talking about earlier, and that's the landscape.
Uh-huh.
And how that becomes character, like I know you include in your works there, it could be a forest fire, it could be a flood. And how do you work that in to add to, it's just not in the background, but it's a powerful element within the story.
Well, I have discovered of myself a couple of things. One thing is that I am a very fearful person. And I think when I put my characters in dangerous situations, it's one way for me to kind of emotionally walk through something that might be terrifying to people. And then I don't have to deal with it. I don't have to rush out and save somebody mm-hmm. from a flood or a fire, but I can vicariously think through it. And then also because I tend to be character-driven, not action, I know this can be a shortcoming. So by putting in an external setting and things happening outside, that helps me move the plot forward too.
Yeah, that idea, and I was talking to a friend, and he was reminiscing about a time 30 years ago when he was kind of caught up in a wildfire.
Oh.
And the only way out was up the hill with a bunch of trees, which is nothing but fuel, right? And, so if the story is a story development, you know, like a well-told story, then it gets down to how did he get out of this? But if it's character-driven, it's what was he feeling? What was that terror that he must have in there? Because, you know, it's one thing to whodunit. It's another thing to like, oh, my God, I could be a marshmallow here and, you know, fricasseed.
Yeah, and what I have found that YouTube is a wonderful resource for me because obviously I've never lived through a forest fire or a flash flood, but if you go on YouTube, you can find lots of videos that help capture those moments. And in this particular new book, Never Retreat, I depended very heavily on the Colorado History Center. You know, they have a library there, and they had some transcripts from people who survived the big Thompson flood, which is now, I think, at least 30 years ago.
40. It was in 1976.
Just so emotional.
Yes.
I mean, and obviously they couldn't interview the people that died, but they interviewed the people that were witnesses, and that impacted my whole approach to the flash flood scenes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's interesting you bring that up because that was that's such a one of those moments in Colorado history.
Right.
And because we did have mass media at that time,
mm-hmm.
okay, and literally the footage that's on Channel 4, Channel 9 would still be archived there.
That's true.
And people trying to escape out of that canyon, trying to climb up these muddy hills and grabbing onto a branch that just pops out in your hand.
That's
because
right. The
ground is so wet, then there's no root grasping, you know, holding onto it and seeing that water just right and raging, not just the gentle, like, oh, this is like level 4, whatever they call it, in white water rafting, right? No, this is like, and you get into that, you're dead.
That's right. Yeah. Until people see it, or I don't want to say live it because I just saw it, I don't think they understand how extreme Mother Nature can be.
In a heartbeat.
Yes.
Yeah, fascinating there. When, you know, you've been writing for years, I've been writing now, people approach you and say, you know, I've always thought about, you know, writing a book or whatever. What do you say? I mean, you know, you certainly encourage him, I'm sure, you know, but...
Oh, no, I discourage him. We have way too many writers.
Buy my
way
book.
Too many books. Don't do it. Oh, well, one thing I try to determine is how serious are they? Because, at least in my experience, it's been a long, slow slog with lots of discouragement. And if they think they're going to overnight become millionaires, they're unrealistic.
Right.
And that's usually, you know, younger people think that. Oh, I'll just write a bestseller. I'm sorry, it doesn't happen like that. You have to build your credentials and build your own experience. And the old advice that comes from people over the eons is read, 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 write, write, write.
Yeah, and you know, you make a great point there, Bonnie, about so many authors, because what's facilitated so many of us being able to use our work is simply the technology.
That's right.
You could put stuff up online, Amazon, CreateSpace, Ingram Sparks, all this other stuff. I mean, you could put a lot. That's the advantage. The downside is there's a million other people doing the exact same thing.
That's right. How do you market it? How do you distribute it? It's a real challenge.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's what I discovered is that when you think you're done right after you finished a manuscript, you just got the easy part done.
That's right.
You know. But if your heart is in it, your passion, and if you're writing not to become a millionaire, but you have a story to tell or a work to create, and you simply do it and detach, and realize that it's probably going to cost you far more than, you know, financially and your time, and you're not probably going to get all that back. But what I point out to people and say, you know, I could have spent a lot of that money, you know, and traveled. I'd been great. I still want to do that. I played Hank Snow earlier too. I've been everywhere, and I said not yet, but that's one of my goals is to get there. You know, but when I die, that memory and everything goes with me. You write a book and you put it in the Library of Congress. You're right there
with
Thomas Jefferson and a bunch of other, you know, so, you know, also Rand's too, right?
Well, and finally, after having people tell me for decades, it's not the result, it's the journey that you're on that counts. And I have gotten so much back from writing. I've learned about myself. I've learned about other people. I've had excuses to be snoopy. I have reasons to keep reading all kinds of things. And getting all that for myself, to develop myself, has been really much more important than whatever pittance I've been able to make on my books.
Yeah, and I think that's an excellent point there about how much you learn about yourself as well through your characters, but also just in the process and all the great stuff. You know, I started, you know, I've been on the radio here for 14 years, you know, whatever, but it was only a couple of years ago, and you were one of my first guests, and I created this, you know, segment called Writer's Talk, and now I have people, I sat on a panel today with the Colorado Independent Publishers Association talking about going on the radio. Why do you talk, you know, and what do you want to promote, and all this other stuff there, and my universe has just exploded with these wonderful people, wonderful stories, so... You know, it's, you know, but it's not an easy haul either.
No, and you learn to take criticism or suggestions, that's for sure.
Yep.
You kind of build a little tough shells to an extent.
Well, you got some signings coming up.
Yeah, I have two appearances coming up in May. On Saturday, May 12th, I have a book launch at the Barnes & Noble on South Colorado Boulevard, 1 p.m., and then a week later, on Sunday the 20th, I'm with two of my friends who are also authors on Women in Writing, and we're going to talk about characters and what do characters mold you? Do they mold the story? And that's at the Denver Women's Press Club at 130, 1325 Logan Street in Denver. And certainly you can access those information on my website about that stuff.
And your website is?
www.BonnieMcCune.com, and that's B-O-N-N-I-E, and then M-C-C-U-N-E.com.
Okay. BonnieMcCune.com, and you got some events coming up here, and people want to check out your work, obviously, to your website?
Yeah.
Anywhere else?
Yeah. Well, I don't know. Where else would it be?
Barnes & Noble.
Oh, that's right. Barnes & Noble.
Amazon. Yeah. You know, that sort of thing.
Yeah, Barnes & Noble, Amazon.
But you can learn a lot more about, because what I find, too, is that when people go to the author's website to learn about the work and learn more about you, and you got you in there, and you start getting this identity connection with.
Well, I'd love to connect with readers, because that's that interaction is really... it's satisfying. It kind of makes you feel good that at least somebody's paying attention.
Exactly.
Yeah,
we got to pay attention. So, all right, Bonnie, welcome, or thank you for coming. You were welcome to you an hour ago. And, you know, appreciate you coming in, and, you know, and good luck with the book.
Okay. Thanks so much for having me. This is just... Idaho Springs is such a wonderful small town, even though we have a lot of construction downtown right now. Yeah.
Well, it's on the east end. That's why I tell people, get off on 240 and avoid that down there. And it goes a lot faster. And it'll be done in a few months. But
And keep me updated about your progress, too.
I will do so.
I know you're doing bang-up work in the writing community generally, too. So we're very appreciative of that.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it's become a kind of a passion for me, you know, not only my own writing, but to promote others. I was a teacher. I always encourage my students. And
I'm trying to write a book with my 16-year-old grandson. That's an experience.
And what's the topic?
Oh, it's a young adult thriller. It's about a private school where a bad headmaster comes in, wreaks havoc.
All right. And maybe you stuff him in a refrigerator.
No, I would never do that. That would be very bad.
Yeah, I know. All right. All right, everyone. Hey, this is Jerry Fabiana, KYGT, LPFM 102.7, 103.9, visiting here with Bonnie McCune. Her latest work is Never Retreat, Falling Like a Rock, a number of others, and Irish Episodes, and I've been writing quite a bit. A fascinating conversation here about character development, too. And this show, of course, has been recorded. We will... rebroadcast it next week, same time on Monday and Thursday, so okay. 1 o'clock, and then I will have it up on the Bighorn Book Club website here probably by Monday or so, and so you can listen to your own leisure at that okay. time, just simply online there. So great stuff, and once again, Bonnie, thanks so much for coming
in. Thanks so much for hosting this.
You bet, and I'll be back in about 10 minutes, next author or next guest. In the meantime, a little bit of music for you. Go ahead, take a break and get that cup of coffee, hot chocolate, whatever, however you're going to do it, and we'll be right back.